breath sharply then and put both hands on her distended abdomen. I stared, seeing her belly draw up suddenly tight and round. She bit her lip and breathed heavily for a moment, then relaxed. Her belly had resumed its normal shape, a slightly pendant teardrop, rounded at both ends. Ian put a hand hesitantly on her shoulder, and she covered it with her own, smiling up at him. "Then tell her to feed you, man. You and Jamie will be needing a bit to eat. They say the second babe comes faster than the first. Maybe by the time you've done with breakfast, I'll be ready for a bite myself." He squeezed her shoulder tightly and kissed her, murmuring something in her ear before turning to go. He hesitated in the doorway, looking back, but she waved him firmly away. It seemed a very long time before Jamie arrived with the midwife, and I grew more nervous as the contractions grew stronger. Second babies were said to be faster as a rule. What if this one decided to arrive before Mrs. Martin's? At first, Jenny carried on light conversation with me, only pausing to bend forward slightly, holding her stomach, as the contractions tightened their grip. But she quickly lost the urge to talk and lay back, resting quietly in between the increasingly powerful pains. Finally, after one that almost bent her double in her chair, she rose to her feet, staggering. "Help me walk a bit, Claire," she said. Unsure what was the proper procedure, I did as she said, grasping her tightly under the arm to help her stand upright. We made several slow circuits of the room, pausing when a contraction struck, going on when it eased. Shortly before the midwife arrived, Jenny made her way to the bed and lay down. Mrs. Martins was a reassuring-looking person. Tallish and thin, she had wide shoulders and muscular forearms, and the sort of kind, down-to-earth expression that invited confidence. Two vertical creases between her iron-grey brows, always visible, deepened when she was concentrating. They stayed shallow as she made her preliminary examination. Everything normal so far, then. Mrs. Crook had produced a pile of clean iron sheets for our use, and Mrs. Martins took one of these, still folded, and pushed it under Jenny. I was startled to see the dark stain of blood between her thighs as she raised herself slightly. Seeing my look, Mrs. Martins nodded reassuringly. "Aye, bloody shoe it's called. It's all right. It's only when the blood is bright red and a terrible lot all at once that you worry. There's nothing wrong." We all settled down to wait. Mrs. Martins talked quietly and comfortingly to Jenny, rubbing the small of her back, pressing hard during the contractions. As the pains became more frequent, Jenny began to clamp her lips together and snort heavily through her nose. Often there was a deep, faint groan as the full force of the pain came on. Jenny's hair was soaked with perspiration by this time, and her face bright red with the strain. Watching her, I realized fully why it was called labor. Giving birth was bloody hard work. Over the next 2 hours, little progress appeared to be made, except that the pains grew obviously stronger. Able at first to answer questions, Jenny quit responding, lying panting at the end of each contraction, face fading from red to white in a matter of seconds. She clamped her lips to the next one, beckoning me to her side as it eased. "If the child lives," she said, gasping for air. "And it's a girl. Her name is Margaret. Tell Ian, name her Margaret Ellen." "Yes, of course," I soothed. "But you'll be able to tell him yourself. It won't be long now." She only shook her head in determined negation and clenched her teeth as the next pain came. Mrs. Martins took me by the arm, steering me away. "Dinna mind it, lassie," she said matter-of-factly. "They always think they're going to die about now." "Oh," I said, mildly relieved. "Mind you," she said in a lower voice, "sometimes they do." Even Mrs. Martins seemed a trifle worried as the pains went on, with no appreciable progress. Jenny was tiring badly. As each pain eased, her body went slack, and she even dozed off as though seeking escape in small intervals of sleep. Then, as the remorseless fist grasped her once again, she would wake, fighting and groaning with effort, writhing to the side to curl protectively over the rigid lump of the unborn child. "Could the child be backward?" I asked in a low voice, shy about suggesting such a thing to an experienced midwife. Mrs. Martin seemed not at all offended by the suggestion, though. The lines between her brows merely deepened as she looked at the straining woman. When the next pain eased, Mrs. Martin's flung back the sheet and nightgown and went rapidly to work, pressing here and there on the huge mound with quick, skilled fingers. It took several tries, as the probing seemed to incite the pains, and examination was impossible during the relentlessly powerful contractions. At last she drew back, thinking, tapping one foot abstractedly as she watched Jenny writhe through two more of the spine-wrenching pains. As she jerked on the sheets, one of the strained linens parted suddenly with a rending tear. As though this had been a signal, Mrs. Martin started forward with decision, beckoning to me. "Lean her back a bit, lass," Mrs. Martin's instructed me, not at all disconcerted by Jenny's cries. I suppose she had heard her share of screaming. At the next relaxation, Mrs. Martin's plunged into action. Grasping the child through the momentarily flaccid walls of the womb, she heaved, trying to turn it. Jenny screamed and jerked my arms as another contraction started. Mrs. Martin's tried again, and again, and again. Unable to keep from pushing, Jenny was wearing herself far past the point of exhaustion, her body struggling past the bounds of ordinary strength as it strove to force the child into the world. Then it worked. There was a sudden, strange, fluid shifting, and the amorphous bulk of the child turned under Mrs. Martin's hands. All at once, the shape of Jenny's belly was altered, and there was an immediate sense of getting down to business. "No, push!" she did, and Mrs. Martin's dropped to her knees beside the bed. Apparently she saw some sign of progress, for she rose and hastily snatched a small bottle from the table where she had put it when she came in. She poured a small amount of what looked like oil on her fingertips and began to rub it gently between Jenny's legs. Jenny made a deep and vicious sound of protest at being touched as the next pain came on, and Mrs. Martin's took her hand away. Jenny sagged into inertness, and the midwife resumed her gentle massage, crooning to her patient, telling her everything was well, just to rest, and now push. During the next contraction, Mrs. Martin's put her hand on top of Jenny's belly and pushed down strongly. Jenny shrieked, but the midwife kept pushing until the contraction eased. "Push with me on the next one," the midwife said. "It's almost here." I put my hands above Mrs. Martin's on Jenny's belly, and at her signal, all three of us pushed together. There was a deep, victorious grunt from Jenny, and a slimy blob swelled suddenly between her thighs. She straightened her legs against the mattress and pushed once more, and Margaret Ellen Murray shot into the world like a greased pig. A little later, I straightened from wiping Jenny's smiling face with a damp rag and glanced out the window. It was nearly sunset. "I'm all right," Jenny said. "Quite all right." The broad grin of delight with which she had greeted the delivery of her daughter had turned into a small, permanent smile of deep contentment. She reached up with an unsteady hand and touched my sleeve.
"Gutelian," she said. "He'll be worried."
To my cynical eyes, it didn't look it. The scene in the study, where Ian and Jamie had taken refuge, strongly resembled a premature celebratory debauch. An empty decanter stood on the sideboard, accompanied by several bottles, and a strong alcoholic fume hung over the room like a cloud. The proud father appeared to have passed out, head resting on the laird's desk. The laird himself was still conscious, but but bleary-eyed, leaning back against the panelling and blinking like an owl. Outraged, I stamped over to the desk and gripped Ian by the shoulder, shaking him roughly and ignoring Jamie, who pushed himself upright, saying, "Sassenach, wait." Ian wasn't quite unconscious. His head came up reluctantly, and he looked at me with a set, rigid face, eyes bleak and pleading holes. I realized suddenly that he thought I had come to tell him that Jenny was dead. I relaxed my grip and patted him gently instead. "She's all right," I said softly. "You have a daughter." He laid his head down on his arms again, and I left him, his thin shoulders shaking as Jamie patted his back. The survivors now revived and cleaned up. The Murray Fraser family is gathered in Jenny's room for a celebratory supper. Little Margaret, tidied for inspection and swaddled in a small blanket, was given to her father, who received his new offspring with an expression of beatific reverence. "Hallo, wee Maggie," he whispered, touching the tiny button of a nose with one fingertip. His new daughter, unimpressed by the introduction, closed her eyes in concentration, stiffened, and urinated on her father's shirt. During the brief bustle of hilarity and repair occasioned by this lapse of good manners, small Jamie succeeded in escaping from the clutches of Mrs. Crook and flung himself onto Jenny's bed. She grunted slightly in discomfort, but put out a hand and gathered him in, waving at Mrs. Crook to let him be.
"My mama,"
he declared, burrowing into Jenny's side.
"Well, who else?"
she asked reasonably.
"Here, laddie."
She hugged him and kissed the top of his head, and he relaxed, reassured, and snuggled against her. She gently pushed his head down, stroking his hair.
"Lay your head then, man," she said. "Past your bedtime. Lay your head."
Comforted by her presence, he put a thumb in his mouth and fell asleep. Given a turn to hold the baby, Jamie proved remarkably competent, cupping the small fuzzy skull in the palm of one hand like a tennis ball. He seemed reluctant to hand the child back to Jenny, who cuddled her against her breasts, crooning soft endearments. At last, we made our way to our own room, which seemed silent and empty in contrast to the warm family scene we had just left, Ian kneeling by his wife's bed, hand resting on small Jamie as Jenny nursed the new baby. I was conscious for the first time of just how tired I was. It was nearly 24 hours since Ian had roused me. Jamie closed the door quietly behind him. Without speaking, he came behind me and undid the fastenings of my gown. His hands reached around me, and I lay back gratefully against his chest. Then he bent his head to kiss me, and I turned, putting my own arms around his neck. I felt not only very tired, but very tender, and not a little sad.
"Perhaps it's as well,"
Jamie said slowly, as though to himself.
"What's as well?"
"That you're barren."
He couldn't see my face, buried in his chest, but he must have felt me stiffen.
"Aye, I knew that long ago. Gillis Duncan told me soon after we wed."
He stroked my back gently.
I regretted it a bit at first, but then I began to think it was as well, living as we must. It would be very difficult if you were to get with child. And now?
He shivered slightly.
"Now I think I'm glad of it. I wouldn't want you to suffer that way."
"I wouldn't mind," I said, after a long while, thinking of the rounded fuzzy head and tiny fingers.
"I would."
He kissed the top of my head.
I saw Ian's face. It was like his own flesh was being torn each time Jenny screamed.
My arms were around him, stroking the ridged scars on his back.
"I can bear pain myself," he said softly, "but I couldna bear yours. That would take more strength than I have."
Chapter 33 The Watch. Jenny recovered rapidly after Margaret's birth, insisting on coming downstairs the day following the delivery. At the combined insistence of Ian and Jamie, she reluctantly refrained from doing any work, only supervising from the sofa in the parlour where she reclined, baby Margaret sleeping in her cradle alongside. Not content to sit idle, though, within a day or two she had ventured as far as the kitchen, and then the back garden. Sitting on the wall, the well-wrapped baby in a carrying sling, she was keeping me company as I simultaneously pulled dead vines and kept an eye on the enormous cauldron in which the household's laundry was boiled. Mrs. Crook and the maids had already removed the clean wash to be hung and dried. Now I was waiting for the water to cool sufficiently to be dumped out. Small Jamie was helping me, yanking out plants with mad abandon and flinging bits of stick in all directions. I called a warning as he ventured too near the cauldron, then raced after him as he ignored me. Luckily, the pot had cooled quickly. The water was no more than warm. Warning him to keep back with his mother, I grasped the pot and tilted it away from the iron contrivance that held it and kept it from falling. I sprang out of the way as the dirty water cascaded over the lip of the pot, steaming in the chilly air. Young Jamie, squatting beside me on his heels, splatted his hands joyfully in the warm mud, and black droplets flew all over my skirts. His mother slid down from the wall, yanked him up by the collar, and dealt him a smart clout on the backside.
"Have you no sense, Gilia? Look at you. There's your shirt will have to go and be washed again. And look what you've done to your auntie's skirt, you wee heathen."
"It doesn't matter," I protested, seeing the miscreant's lower lip quiver.
"Well, it matters to me," said Jenny, giving her offspring the benefit of a gimlet eye.
"Say sorry to your auntie, laddie, and get ye into the house and have Mrs. Crook give ye a bit of a wash."
She patted his bottom, gently this time, and gave him a push in the direction of the house. We were turning back to the mass of sodden clothes when the sound of hoofbeats came from the road.
"That'll be Jamie, I expect," I said, listening. "He's early, though."
Jenny shook her head, peering intently toward the road.
"Not his horse."
The horse, when it appeared at the crest of a hill, wasn't one she knew, to judge from her frown. The man aboard, though, was no stranger. She stiffened beside me, then began to run toward the gate, wrapping both arms around the baby to hold it steady.
"It's Ian," she called to me.
He was tattered and dusty and bruised about the face as he slid off his horse. One bruise on his forehead was swollen, with a nasty split that went through the eyebrow. Jenny caught him under the arm as he hit the ground, and it was only then I saw that his wooden leg was gone.
"Jamie," he gasped, "we met the watch near the mill, waiting for us. They knew we were coming."
My stomach lurched. "Is he alive?" He nodded, panting for breath.
"Aye, not wounded either. They took him to the west, towards Killin."
Jenny's fingers were exploring his face.
"Are you bad hurt, man?"
He shook his head.
"No, I took my horse and my leg. They didn't need to kill me to stop me following."
Jenny glanced at the horizon, where the sun lay just above the trees. "Maybe 4 o'clock, I estimated. Ian followed her gaze and anticipated her question.
"We met them near midday. It took me over 2 hours to get to a place that had a horse."
She stood still for a moment, calculating, then turned to me with decision.
"Claire, help Ian to the house, will you? And if he needs aught in the way of doctoring, do it as fast as you can. I'll give the babe to Mrs. Crook and fetch the horses."
She was gone before either of us could protest.
"Does she mean... But she can't," I exclaimed. "She can't mean to leave the baby."
Ian was leaning heavily on my shoulder as we made our way slowly up the path to the house. He shook his head.
"Maybe not, but I dinna think she means to let the English hang her brother, either."
It was growing dark by the time we reached the spot where Jamie and Ian had been ambushed. Jenny slid off her horse and cast about through the bushes like a small terrier, pushing branches out of the way and muttering things under her breath that sounded suspiciously like some of her brother's better curses. East, she said, finally coming out of the trees, scratched and dirty. She beat dead leaves from her skirt and took her horse's reins from my numbed hands. We cannot follow in the dark, but at least I know which way to go come the dawn. We made a simple camp, hobbling the horses and building a small fire. I admired the efficiency with which Jenny had done it, and she smiled. I used to make Jamie and Ian show me things when they were young, how to build fires and climb trees, even how to skin things, and how to track. She glanced again in the direction taken by the watch. Dinna worry, Claire. She smiled at me and sat down by the fire. 20 horses canna go far through the brush, but 2 can. The watch will be taking the road toward Eskerdale by the looks of it. We can cut over the hills and meet them near Mid-Mains. Her nimble fingers were tugging at the bodice of her gown. I stared in amazement as she spread the folds of cloth and pulled down the top of her underblouse to show her breasts. They were very large and looked hard, swollen with milk. In my ignorance, I hadn't thought to wonder what a nursing mother does if deprived of her nursling. "I canna leave the babe for long," she said in answer to my thoughts, grimacing as she cut one breast from beneath. "I'll burst." In response to the touch, milk had begun to drip from the engorged nipple, thin and bluish. Pulling a large kerchief from her pocket, Jenny tucked it beneath her breast. There was a small pewter cup on the ground beside her, one she had taken from the saddlebag. Pressing the lip of the cup just below the nipple, she gently stroked the breast between 2 fingers, squeezing gently toward the nipple. The milk dripped faster in response. Then suddenly the areole around the nipple contracted, and the milk spurted out in a tiny jet of surprising force. "I didn't know it did that," I blurted, staring in fascination. Jenny moved the cup to catch the stream and nodded. "Oh, aye. The babe's suckings, that's it, but once the milk lets down, all the child need do is swallow. Oh, that feels better." She closed her eyes briefly in relief. She emptied the cup onto the ground, remarking, "Shame to waste it, but there isna much to do wi' it, is there?" Switching hands, she placed the cup again and repeated the process with the other breast. "It's a nuisance," she said, looking up to see me still watching. "Everything to do wi' bairns is a nuisance, almost. Still, you'd never choose not to have them." "No," I answered softly. "You wouldn't choose that." She looked across the fire at me, face kind and concerned. "It isna your time yet," she said. "But you'll have bairns of your own one day." I laughed, a little shakily. "First, we'd better find the father." She emptied the second cup and began readjusting her dress. "Oh, we'll find them, tomorrow. We have to, for I canna stay away from wee Maggie much longer than that." "And once we've found them," I asked, "what then?" She shrugged and reached for the blanket rolls. "That depends on Jamie, and on how much he's made them hurt him." Jenny was right. We did find the watch the next day. We left our campsite before full day, pausing only long enough for her to express more milk. She seemed to be able to find trails where none existed, and I followed her without question into a heavily wooded area. Quick travel was impossible through the brushy undergrowth, but she assured me that we were taking a much more direct route than the one the watch would have to follow, bound as they were to roads by the size of their group. We came on them near noon. I heard the jingle of harness and the casual voices I had heard once before, and put out a hand to stop Jenny, who was following me for the moment. "There's a ford in the stream below," she whispered to me. "It sounds as though they've stopped there to water the horses." Sliding down, she took both sets of reins and tethered our own horses. Then, beckoning to me to follow, she slid into the undergrowth like a snake. From the vantage point to which she led me, on a small ledge overlooking the ford, we could see almost all of the men of the watch, mostly dismounted and talking in casual groups, some sitting on the ground eating, some leading the horses in groups of two and three to the water. What we couldn't see was Jamie.
"Do you suppose they've killed him?"
I whispered in panic. I had counted every man twice to be sure I had missed no one. There were 20 men and 26 horses, all in plain view so far as I could see, but no hint of a prisoner and no telltale gleam of sun on red hair.
"I doubt it," Jenny answered, "but there's only one way to find out."
She began to squirm backward from the ledge.
"What's that?"
"Ask."
The road narrowed as it left the ford, becoming little more than a dusty trail through dense stands of pine and alder on either side. The trail wasn't wide enough for the watch to ride two abreast. Each man would have to pass down it in single file. As the last man in the line approached a bend in the trail, Jenny Murray stepped suddenly out in the road ahead of him. His horse shied, and the man struggled to rein it in, cursing. As he opened his mouth to demand indignantly what she meant by this behaviour, I stepped out of the bush behind and whacked him solidly behind the ear with a fallen branch. Taken completely by surprise, he lost his balance as the horse shied again and fell off into the roadway. He wasn't stunned. The blow had only knocked him over. Jenny remedied this deficiency with the assistance of a good-sized rock. She grabbed the horse's reins and gestured violently to me.
"Come on," she whispered. "Get him off the road before they notice he's gone."
So it was that when Robert MacDonald of the Glen Elriv Watch recovered consciousness, it was to find himself securely tied to a tree, looking down the barrel of a pistol held by the steely-eyed sister of his erstwhile prisoner.
"What have you done with Jamie Fraser?" she demanded.
MacDonald shook his head dazedly, obviously thinking her a figment of his imagination. An attempt to move put paid to this notion, and after an allowance for the statutory amount of cursing and threatening, he at last reconciled himself to the idea that the only way to get loose was to tell us what we wanted to know.
"He's dead," MacDonald said sullenly.
Then, as Jenny's finger tightened ominously on the trigger, he added in sudden panic,
"That wasn't me. That was his own fault."
Jamie, he said, had been mounted double, arms bound with a leather strap, behind one of the watch, riding between two other men. He had seemed docile enough, and they had taken no particular precautions when fording the river 6 miles from the mill.
"Damn fool threw himself off the horse and into the deep water," said MacDonald, shrugging as well as he could with his hands tied behind him. "We fired at him. Must have hit him, for he didn't have come up again. But the stream's swift just below the ford, and it's deep. We searched a bit, but no body. Must have been carried downstream. Now, for God's sake, ladies, will you no untie me?"
After repeated threats from Jenny had elicited no further details or changes in his story, we had decided to accept it as true. Declining to free MacDonald altogether, Jenny did at least loosen his bonds, so that, given time, he might struggle out of them. Then we ran.
"Do you think he's dead?"
I puffed as we reached the tethered horse.
"I don't.
Jamie swings like a fish, and I've seen him hold his breath for 3 minutes at a time. Come on, we're going to search the river bank."
We cast up and down the banks of the river, stumbling on rocks, splashing in the shallows, scratching our hands and faces on the willows that trawled their branches in the pools. At last, Jenny gave a triumphant shout, and I splashed my way across, balancing precariously on the mossy rocks that lined the bottom of the burn, shallow at this spot. She was holding a leather strap, still fastened in a circle. A smear of blood discoloured one side.
"Wiggled out of it here," she said,
bending the circlet between her hands. She looked back in the direction we had come, down that jagged fall of tangled rocks, deep pools, and foaming rapids, and shook her head.
"However did you manage, Jamie?" she said, half to herself.
We found an area of flattened grass, not far from the verge, where he had evidently lain to rest. I found a small brownish smudge on the bark of an aspen nearby.
"He's hurt," I said.
"Aye, but he's moving," Jenny answered, looking at the ground as she paced back and forth.
"Are you good at tracking?" I asked hopefully.
"I'm no much of a hunter," she replied, setting off with me close behind. "But if I cannot follow something the size of Jamie Fraser through dry bracken, then I'm daft as well as blind."
Sure enough, a broad track of crushed brown fern led up the side of the hill and disappeared into a thick clump of heather. Circling around this point turned up no further evidence, nor did calling produce any answer.
"You'll be gone," Jenny said, sitting down on a log and fanning herself. I thought she looked pale, and realized that kidnapping and threatening armed men was no pursuit for a woman who had given birth less than a week before.
"Jenny," I said, "you have to go back. Besides, he might go back to Lallybroch."
She shook her head.
"No, that he wouldn't. Whatever MacDonald told us, they're no likely to give up so easy, not with a reward at hand. If they haven't hunted him down yet, it's because they couldn't. But they'll have sent someone back to keep an eye on the farm, just in case. No, that's the one place he wouldn't go."
She pulled at the neck of her gown. The day was cold, but she was sweating slightly, and I could see growing dark stains on the bosom of her dress from leaking milk. She saw me looking and nodded.
"Aye, I'll have to go back soon. Mrs. Crook's nursing the lassie wee goat's milk and sugar water, but she canna do without me much longer. Nor me without her. I hate to leave you alone, though."
I didn't much care for the thought of having to hunt alone through the Scottish Highlands for a man who might be anywhere either, but I put a bold face on it.
"I'll manage," I said.
"It could be worse. At least he's alive."
"True."
She glanced at the sun, low over the horizon. "I'll stay with you through the night at least." Huddled around the fire at night, we didn't talk much. Jenny was preoccupied with thoughts of her abandoned child, me with thoughts of just how I was to proceed on my own, alone with no real knowledge of geography or Gaelic. Suddenly, Jenny's head snapped up, listening. I sat up and listened myself, but heard nothing. I peered into the dark woods in the direction Jenny was looking, but saw no gleaming eyes in the depths, thank God. When I turned back to the fire, Murta was sitting on the other side, calmly warming his hands at the blaze. Jenny snapped round at my exclamation and uttered a short laugh of surprise.
"I could have cut both your throats before you ever looked in the right direction," the little man observed.
"Oh, could you then?"
Jenny was sitting with her knees drawn up, hands clasped near her ankles. With a lightning dart, her hand went under her skirt, and the blade of a skean dhu flashed in the firelight.
"None say bad," Murta agreed, nodding sagely. "Is the wee Sassenach that good?"
"No," said Jenny, restoring her blade to her stocking. "So it's good you'll be with her. Ian sent for you, I expect."
The little man nodded.
"Aye. Did you find the watch yet?"
We told him of our progress to date. At the news that Jamie had escaped, I could have sworn that a muscle twitched near the corner of his mouth, but it would have been stretching matters to call it a smile. At length, Jenny rose, folding her blanket.
"Where are you going?"
I asked in surprise.
"Home,"
she nodded at Murta.
"He'll be with you now. You don't need me, and there's others that do."
Murta looked up at the sky. The waning moon was faintly visible behind a haze of cloud, and a soft spatter of rain whispered in the pine boughs above us.
"The morning will do. The wind's rising, and no one will move far tonight."
Jenny shook her head and went on tucking her hair beneath her kerchief. "I know my way, and if none will move tonight, there's none will hinder me on the road, no?" Murta sighed impatiently.
"You're stubborn as your ox of a brother, begging your pardon. Little reason to hurry back, so far as I can see. I doubt your good man will hae ta'en a doxy to his bed in the time you've been gone.
You see as far as the end of your nose, doon you, and that's short enough, Jenny answered sharply. And if you've lived so long without knowing better than to stand between a nursing mother and a hungry child, you've not sense enough to hunt hogs, let alone find a man in the heather. Murta raised his hands in surrender.
Oh, aye, you'll take your own way. I dinna ken I was trying to talk sense to a wild sow. Get a tush through the leg for my trouble, I expect.
Jenny laughed unexpectedly, dimpling.
I expect you might at that, you old rogue.
She bent and heaved the heavy saddle up on her knee.
See that you take care with my good sister then, and send word when you found Jamie.
As she turned to saddle the horse, Murta added,
By the by, you'll reckon to find a new kitchen maid when you reach home.
She paused and eyed him, then slowly set the saddle on the ground. And who might that be? She asked.
The Widow MacNab, he replied, with deliberation.
She was still for a moment, nothing moving but the kerchief and cloak that stirred in the rising wind.
How?
She asked at last. Murta bent to pick up the saddle. He heaved it up and secured the girth with what seemed like one effortless motion.
Fire, he said,
giving a final tug to the stirrup leather.
Watch your way as you pass the high field. The ashes will still be warm.
He cupped his hands to give her a foot up, but she shook her head and took the reins instead, beckoning to me.
Walk we me to the top of the hill, Claire, if you will.
The air was cold and heavy away from the fire. My skirts were damp from sitting on the ground, and clung to my legs as I walked. Jenny's head was bent against the wind, but I could see her profile, lips pale and set with chill.
It was MacNab that gave Jamie to the watch, I asked at last.
She nodded slowly.
Aye. Ian will have found out, or one of the other men. It doesn't matter which.
It was late November, well past Guy Fawkes Day, but I had a sudden vision of a bonfire, flames leaping up timbered walls and sprouting in the thatch like the tongues of the Holy Ghost, while the fire within roared its prayers for the damned. And inside, the guy, an effigy, crouched in ash on his own hearthstone, ready to fall into black dust at the next blast of cold wind to sweep through the shell of his home. There is a fine line sometimes between justice and brutality. I realized Jenny was looking full at me, questioning, and I returned her gaze with a nod.
We stood together, in this case at least, on the same side of that grim and arbitrary line.
We paused at the top of the hill, Murta, a dark speck by the fire below. Jenny rummaged for a moment in the side pocket of her skirt, then pressed a small wash-leather bag into my hand.
"The rent's from quarter day," she said. "You might need it."
I tried to give the money back, insisting that Jamie wouldn't want to take money that was needed for the running of the estate, but she would have none of it. And while Janet Fraser was half her brother's size, she more than matched his stubbornness. Outclassed, I gave up at last, and tucked the money safely away in the recesses of my own costume. At Jenny's insistence, I took also the small skiandu she pressed upon me.
"It's Ian's, but he has another," she said.
"Put it into your stocking top and hold it with your garter. Don't leave it off, even when you sleep."
She paused a moment, as though there was something else she meant to say. Apparently there was.
"Jamie said,"
she said carefully,
"that you might tell me things sometimes. And he said that if you did, I was to do as you said. Is there anything you wish to tell me?"
Jamie and I had discussed the necessity for preparing Lallybroch and its inhabitants against the coming disasters of the Rising. But we had thought then that there was time.
Now I had no time, or most a few minutes,
in which to give this new sister I held dear enough information to guard Lallybroch against the coming storm. Being a prophet was a very uncomfortable occupation, I thought, not for the first time. I felt considerable sympathy with Jeremiah and his lamentations. I also realized exactly why Cassandra was so unpopular. Still, there was no help for it. On the crest of a Scottish hill, the night wind of an autumn storm whipping my hair and skirts like the sheets of a banshee, I turned my face to the shadowed skies and prepared to prophesy. "Plant potatoes," I said. Jenny's mouth dropped slightly open. Then she firmed her jaw and nodded briskly.
"Potatoes?"
"Aye. There's none closer than Edinburgh, but I'll send for them."
"How many?"
"As many as you can. They're not planted in the Highlands now, but they will be. They're a root crop that will keep for a long time, and the yield is better than wheat. Put as much ground as you can into crops that can be stored. There's going to be a famine, a bad one, in 2 years. If there's land or property that's not productive now, sell it for gold. There's going to be war and slaughter. Men will be hunted here and everywhere through the Highlands." I thought for a moment. "Is there a priest hole in the house?"
"No, it was built well after the Protector's time."
"Make one, then, or some safe place to hide."
"I hope Jamie won't need it." I swallowed hard at the thought. "But someone may."
"All right. Is that all?"
Her face was serious and intent in the half-light. I blessed Jamie for his forethought in warning her, and her for her trust in her brother. She didn't ask me how or why, but only took careful note of what I said, and I knew my hasty instructions would be followed.
"That's all.
All I can think of just now, anyway." I tried to smile, but the effort seemed unconvincing, even to me.
"Hers was better."
She touched my cheek briefly in farewell.
"God go with you, Claire. We'll meet again
when you bring my brother home." Part 6. The Search. Chapter 34. Dougal's Story. Whatever the disadvantages of civilization, I reflected grimly, the benefits were undeniable. Take telephones, for example. For that matter, take newspapers, which were popular in such metropolitan centres as Edinburgh or even Perth, but completely unknown in the wilderness of the Scottish Highlands. With no such methods of mass communication, news spread from one person to the next at the speed of a man's stride. People generally found out what they needed to know, but with a delay of several weeks. Consequently, faced with the problem of finding exactly where Jamie was, there was little to rely on except the possibility of someone encountering him and sending word back to Lallybroch. That was a process that might take weeks, and the winter would set in shortly, making travel to Bewley impossible. I sat feeding sticks to the fire, pondering the possibilities. Which way would Jamie have gone from the point of his escape? Not back to Lallybroch, to be sure, and almost certainly not north into the Mackenzie lands. South to the borderlands, where he might meet again with Hugh Munro or some of his earlier rough companions? No, most likely northeast, toward Bewley. But if I could figure that out, so could the men of the watch. Murta returned from his gathering, dumping an armload of sticks on the ground. He sat down, cross-legged, on a fold of his plaid, wrapping the rest around himself to keep out the chill. He cast an eye toward the sky, where the moon glowed behind racing clouds.
"It will not snow just yet," he said, frowning. "Another week, maybe two. We might reach Bewley before then."
"Well, nice to have confirmation of my deductions, I supposed."
"You think he'll be there?"
The little clansman shrugged, hunching his plaid higher around his shoulders.
"No telling. The trouble will no be as easy for him, lying hid during the day and staying off the roads. And he hasna got a horse.
He scratched his stubbled chin thoughtfully.
We canna find him. We'd best let him find us.
How? Send up flares? I suggested sarcastically.
One thing about Murter, no matter what incongruous thing I said, he could be counted on to behave as though I hadn't spoken. I've brought your wee packet of medicines, he said, nodding toward the saddlebags on the ground. And you've enough for a reputation near Lallybroch. You'll be known as a healer through most of the countryside near.
He nodded to himself.
Aye, that'll do well enough.
And without further explanations, he lay down, rolled up in his plaid, and went calmly to sleep, ignoring the wind in the trees, the light patter of rain, and me. I found out soon enough what he meant. Travelling openly and slowly along the main roads, we stopped at every croft and village and hamlet we came to. There he would make a quick survey of the local populace, round up anyone suffering from illness or injury, and bring them to me for treatment. Physicians being few and far between in these parts, there was always someone ailing to attend to. While I was occupied with my tonics and salves, he would chat idly with the friends and relatives of the afflicted, taking care to describe the path of our journey toward Beaulieu. If by chance there were no patients to be seen in a place, we would pause nonetheless for the night, seeking shelter at a cottage or tavern. In these places, Murta would sing to entertain our hosts and earn our supper, stubbornly insisting that I preserve all the money I had with me in case it should be needed when we found Jamie. Not naturally inclined toward conversation, he taught me some of his songs to pass the time as we plodded on from place to place.
"You've a decent voice," he observed one day after a moderately successful attempt at the doughy dens of Yarrow. "Not well trained, but strong and true enough. Try it once more, and you'll sing it with me tonight. There's a wee tavern at Limerick."
"Do you really think this will work?" I asked.
"What we're doing, I mean."
He shifted about in the saddle before answering.
No natural horseman, he always looked like a monkey trained to ride a horse, but still managed to dismount fresh as a daisy at day's end, while I could barely manage to hobble my horse before staggering off to collapse. "Oh, aye," he said at last, "sooner or later. You're seeing more sick folk these days, no?"
This was true, and I admitted as much.
"Well, then,"
he said, proving his point,
"that means word of your skill is spreading, and that's what we want. But we could maybe do better. That's why you'll sing tonight. And perhaps..."
He hesitated, as though reluctant to suggest something. "Perhaps what?"
"Know anything about fortune-telling, do you?"
he asked warily.
I understood the reason for his hesitancy. He had seen the frenzy of the witch-hunt at Cranesmuir.
I smiled. "A bit. You want me to try it?"
"Aye. The more we can offer, the more folk will come to see us and go back to tell others. And word will spread about us till the lad hears of us. And that's when we'll find him. Game to try, are you?"
I shrugged. "If it will help, why not?" I made my debut as singer and fortune-teller that night at Limerick, with considerable success. I found that Mrs. Graham had been right in what she had told me. It was the faces, not the hands, that gave you the necessary clues. Our fame spread little by little, until by the next week people were running out of their cottages to greet us as we rode into a village, and showering us with pennies and small gifts as we rode away. "You know, we could really make something of this," I remarked one evening, stowing the night's takings away. "Too bad there's no theatre anywhere near. We could do a proper music hall turn, Magical Murta and his glamorous assistant Gladys." Murta treated this remark with his usual taciturn indifference. But it was true. We really did quite well together. Perhaps it was because we were united in our quest, despite our very basic personality differences. The weather grew increasingly bad, and our pace even slower, but there was as yet no word from Jamie. Outside Belladrum one night, in a driving rain, we met with a band of real gypsies. I blinked disbelievingly at the tiny cluster of painted caravans in the clearing near the road. It looked exactly like a camp of the gypsy bands that came to Hampstead Down every year. The people looked the same too, swarthy, cheerful, loud, and welcoming. Hearing the jingle of our harness, a woman's head poked out of the window of one caravan. She looked us over for a moment, then gave a shout, and the ground under the trees was suddenly alive with grinning brown faces.
"Give me your purse for safekeeping,"
said Murta, unsmiling, watching the young man swaggering toward us with a gay disregard of the rain soaking his colourful shirt.
"And dinna turn your back on anyone."
I was cautious, but we were welcomed with expansive motions and invited to share the gypsies' dinner. It smelt delicious, some sort of stew, and I eagerly accepted the invitation, ignoring Murta's dour speculations as to the basic nature of the beast that had provided the stew meat. They spoke little English, and less Gaelic. We conversed largely in gestures, and a sort of bastard tongue that owed its parentage largely to French. It was warm and companionable in the caravan where we ate. Men and women and children all ate casually from bowls, sitting wherever they could find space, dipping the succulent stew up with chunks of bread. It was the best food I had had in weeks, and I ate until my sides creaked. I could barely muster breath to sing, but did my best, humming along in the difficult spots, and leaving Murta to carry the tunes. Our performance was greeted with rapturous applause, and the gypsies reciprocated, a young man singing some sort of wailing lament to the accompaniment of an ancient fiddle. His performance was punctuated by the crashing of a tambourine wielded with some gravity by a little girl of about 8. While Murta had been circumspect in his inquiries in the villages and crofts we visited, with the gypsies he was entirely open. To my surprise, he told them bluntly who we sought, a big man with hair like fire and eyes like the summer skies. The gypsies exchanged glances up and down the aisle of the caravan, but there was a unanimous shaking of regretful heads. No, they hadn't seen him. And here the leader, the purple-shirted young man who had welcomed us, pantomimed the sending of a messenger, should they happen across the man we sought. I bowed, smiling, and Murta, in turn, pantomimed the handing across of money for information received. This bit of business was greeted with smiles, but also with gazes of speculation. I was glad when Murta declared that we couldn't stay the night, but must be on our way, thank you just the same. He shook out a few coins from his sporran, taking care to exhibit the fact that it held only a small handful of coppers. Distributing these by way of thanks for the supper, we made our exit, followed by voluble protestations of farewell, gratitude, and good wishes. At least, that's what I assumed they were. They might actually have been promising to follow us and cut our throats, and Murta behaved rather as though this had been the case, leading the horses at a gallop to the crossroads 2 miles distant, then ducking aside into the vegetation for a substantial detour before re-emerging onto the road again. Murta glanced up and down the road, empty in the fading, rain-soaked dusk. "Do you really think they followed us?" I asked curiously.
"I dinna ken, but since there's 12 of them and no but the 2 of us, I thought we'd best act as though they did."
This seemed sound reasoning, and I followed him without question through several more evasive manoeuvres, arriving at last in Ross Moor, where we found shelter in a barn. Snow fell the next day. Only a light fall, enough to dust the ground with a white like the flour on the millhouse floor. But it worried me. I didn't like to think of Jamie, alone and unsheltered in the heather, braving winter's storms in nothing but the shirt and plaid he'd been wearing at his capture by the watch. 2 days later, the messenger came. The sun was still above the horizon, but it was evening already in the rock-walled glens. The shadows lay so deep under the leafless trees that the path, what there was of one, was nearly invisible. Fearful of losing the messenger in the gathering dusk, I walked so closely behind him that once or twice I actually trod on the trailing hem of his cloak. At last, with an impatient grunt, he turned and thrust me ahead of him, steering me through the dusk with a heavy hand on my shoulder. It felt as though we had been walking for a long time. I had long since lost track of our turnings amid the towering boulders and thick, dead undergrowth. I could only hope that Murto was somewhere behind, keeping within earshot, if not within sight. The man who had come to the tavern to fetch me, a middle-aged gypsy with no English, had flatly refused to have anyone but me accompany him, pointing emphatically first at Murto and then the ground to indicate that he must stay put. The night chill came on fast at this time of year, and my heavy cloak was barely enough protection against the sudden gusts of icy wind that met us in the open spaces of the clearings. I was torn between dismay at the thought of Jamie lying through the cold, wet nights of autumn without shelter, and excitement at the thought of seeing him again. A shiver ran up my spine that had nothing to do with the cold. At last, my guide pulled me to a halt, and with a precautionary squeeze of my shoulder, stepped off the path and disappeared. I stood, as patiently as could be managed, hands folded under my arms for warmth. I was sure my guide, or someone, would return. I hadn't paid him, for one thing. Still, the wind rattled through the dead brambles like the passing of a deer's ghost, still in panic-stricken flight from the hunter. And the damp was seeping through the seams of my boots. The otter-fat waterproofing had worn away, and I'd had no chance to reapply it. My guide reappeared as suddenly as he had left, making me bite my tongue as I stifled a squeak of surprise. With a jerk of his head, he bade me follow him, and pressed aside a screen of dead alders for me to pass. The cave entrance was narrow. There was a lantern burning on a ledge, silhouetting the tall figure that turned toward the entrance to meet me. I flung myself forward, realizing, even before I touched him, that it wasn't Jamie. Disappointment struck me like a blow in the stomach, and I had to step back and swallow several times to choke back the heavy bile that rose in my throat. I clenched my hands at my sides, digging my fists into my thighs until I felt calm enough to speak. "Rather out of your territory, aren't you?" I said, in a voice that surprised me by its coolness. Dougal Mackenzie had watched my struggle for control, not without some sympathy on his dark face. Now he took my elbow and led me farther into the cave. There were a number of bundles piled against the far side, many more than a single horse could carry. He wasn't alone then, and whatever he and his men carried, it was something he preferred not to expose to the curious gaze of innkeepers and hostlers. "Smuggling, I suppose," I said, with a nod toward the bundle. Then I thought better and answered my own question. "No, not exactly smuggling. Goods for Prince Charles, hm?" He didn't bother to answer me, but sat down on a boulder opposite me, hands on his knees.
"I've news," he said abruptly.
I took a deep breath, bracing myself. News, and not good news, from the expression on his face. I took another breath, swallowed hard, and nodded. "Tell me."
"He's alive," he said,
and the largest of the ice lumps in my stomach dissolved. Dougal cocked his head to one side, watching intently. To see whether I was going to faint, I wondered dimly. It didn't matter. I wasn't.
"He was taken near Kilterlitty 2 weeks ago," Dougal said, still watching me.
"Not his fault. Poor luck. He met 6 dragoons face to face round a turn in the path, and one recognized him."
"Was he hurt?" My voice was still calm, but my hands were beginning to shake. I pressed them flat against my legs to still them. Dougal shook his head.
"Not as I heard."
He paused a moment.
"He's in Wentworth Prison,"
he said reluctantly. "Wentworth," I repeated mechanically.